So, okay, let me write down the title since there wasn't anything announced beforehand. So, this is going to be about a more general notion of gauge gravity duality. And in particular, it will be about field theories with RG flows. So that means that the coupling constants are running with energy scale. So we've had many talks about IdeaCFT and various aspects, but in principle, the greatest advantage of this is that it provides a powerful tool to study in a systematic way strongly coupled gauge theories. And now, although we saw various ways in which IdeaCFT itself is useful, and n equals 4 super mules can tell us useful things and capture some properties of QCD or so, still, n equals 4 super mules is not really the gauge theory that we want to study if you want to address actual phenomenological gauge theories. So I'm going to give you now a kind of a broad overview of various other gauge gravity dualities that allow one to study gauge theories of physical interest. So what that means is less supersymmetry and sometimes even no supersymmetry at all. So these are the things that we want. Less SUSY, not conformal. We also want to have fermions that are in the fundamental representation. So in IdeaCFT, all fermions are in the adjoint representation of the gauge group. So there are no fundamental, or in other words, chiral fermions. And chiral fermions are exactly the fermions, say, in the standard model. The quarks and antiquarks, they are chiral. So if we want to address anything that resembles actual gauge theories of interest, we need to go away from IdeaCFT. And now I'll try to describe ways that we can do that. Well, fermions in fundamental. Representation of gauge group. Just for those who might not know, chiral refers to left or right-handed. So you know that some interactions, like the weak interaction in the standard model, distinguish between left-handed and right-handed particles. For example, the weak interactions gauge bosons only couple to the left-handed fermions. And this has been experimentally observed. This is known as parity violation in nature. So it's really important to have description of chiral fermions, not just any fermions. So we want various things like that, and we want to be able to study confinement, chiral symmetry breaking, whatever. So for all those reasons, like I said, we want to address more general classes of gauge gravity dualities. So I'll try to give a large overview of many things, and therefore the talk will not be very detailed, but I'll give key references here and there. And if you have more questions, you can ask me later or send me an email or come to my office. So again, this will not be very detailed, but I'll try to cover a broad spectrum of ideas. And the plan will be the following. So first I'll describe in general words how one can study RG flows in gauge gravity duality. Then I'll talk about some other notion that arises and is important when one has non-conformal field theories, namely the notion of holographic renormalization. And just like in field theory, renormalization will be used to remove various divergences. However, the ultraviolet divergences in field theory that arise from high energies are going to show up in the gravity dual as infrared divergences arising from going to very large spatial distances. And we're going to see how to systematically remove them. Again, just conceptually, like I said, I'm not going to go into various too much details because there are many things that I want to mention. And after those issues, then I'll talk about adding fundamental fermions or chiral fermions. Up to here, we are only going to have gauge theories that are still having only adjoint, if any, fermions. So then I'll discuss how to add chiral fermions. then hopefully there will be time to discuss one particular holographic model known as Sakai Sugimoto model, which gives a very close description of QCD. Not exactly, but it's the closest that string theory has ever gotten, and it's really quite good. It's capturing most important features, and even numerically it's quite close, like I'll mention soon. So Sakai Sugimoto model, it's also known as holographic QCD. And hopefully, there may not be time for that, but if there is time at the end, I'll mention a little bit about how, in a similar manner like those ideas for the Sakai Sugimoto model, one can use similar things to study dynamical electroweak symmetry breaking. Let me remind to those who may not remember or may not know, electroweak symmetry breaking is in general important for the question of how mass arises in the standard model. So, namely, it arises as a result of electroweak symmetry breaking. And a standard way of doing that is just including a Higgs boson. However, there are various conceptual issues that actually make that not so nice theoretically. And dynamical electroweak symmetry breaking is another alternative that is considered conceptually much more appealing and does not face the problems that a fundamental scalar particle faces, like the Higgs boson. And for the moment, actually, experimentally, the Higgs boson has not been discovered. And there are versions of dynamical electroweak symmetry breaking that are, strictly speaking, at the moment, equally viable. So this is an open issue that hopefully will be decided soon by the Large Hadron Collider. So there is a lot of research these days on computing various observables for electroweak symmetry breaking. And with such models that we are going to get from gauge gravity duality, one can actually compute real observables for LHC. So this is mostly to motivate your interest. Let me now begin. So first about RG flow schema, see everything. Can you see the bottom there? Okay, so this will be a bit schematic, but again, you can ask for more details later and I can give you more references. So here I'll just try to describe conceptually all of those things. So in order to have a RG flow, in general, one wants to have, well, on the gravity side, one wants to have a gravity dual in which, so that's some solution of the string, or rather supergravity equations of motion. Equations of motion, which has non-trivial dependence on some radial direction. On a radial coordinate. So then this radial coordinate can be interpreted or can be viewed as energy scale in the dual field theory. Can be as the energy scale of residual field theory. So one way to understand why this is sensible, it's maybe a bit theoristic, but at this level it's probably the best I can do, is remember that all those gravity duals arise from some kind of brain configurations when we take appropriate limits. So imagine a stack of brains that is the source of some background, so source of geometry. And this is some stack of N D brains. Now, if we take away one of those brains and move it some distance away, these are all at the same place. I just draw them like that. So let's assume that we move one brain away from the others. Then this distance in the field theory is seen like a non-vanishing vacuum expectation value for some scalar field. So remember that the scalars that arise in this field theory on the world volume of the stack of brains are just parameterizing fluctuations in directions transfers to the brains. So when one brain is away, this distance is going to be the vacuum expectation value of a scalar that corresponds to this direction. So some scalar in the field theory. And so this is like a Higgsing of some scalar in the theory. And we know that larger Higgs web in field theory corresponds to larger energy scale. So this is Higgsing. And larger Higgs waves correspond to larger energy scales. So this is one easy way to understand why a suitable radial direction can be identified as energy scale in the dual field theory. It's not any deep derivation, but I think it's enough to give you an idea. Now, let me describe various different ways that are known of obtaining RG flows, gravity duals of RG flows. So ways of obtaining RG flows and one way is to consider geometries that are asymptotically ADS. So in such a case, so asymptotically means when one goes to a large spatial distance, large values of that radial coordinate, then the background becomes ADS. But in the interior, it's not. So that means that at high energies, the field theory becomes conformal, whereas if one goes towards the infrared, it's not. So this kind of geometries describe RG flows of fundamental field theories. The other ways that I'm going to go to soon will be not fundamental or non-normalizable, so that's why I'm pointing these out here. And there are various examples. But the quite well-known prime example for this is, so these are all some kinds of domain wall solutions that interpolate between some other geometry in the infrared and ADS at large distance. So a prime example that is best understood as a domain wall in, well, gauged. This for the moment probably doesn't mean much for many people, but let me just, for being more precise, let me say gauged supergravity. And it was found in this paper, 990947, by some Italian guys. There are many other works after that, but if you start from this, you can find people that cite it. And so this is actually dual to RG flow. So actually, I'll get to the more interesting cases later on. This is a little bit boring because it's easily obtained by deforming superior mules, n equals 4 superior mules. So this RG flow of n equals 1 super young mules, which is obtained by mass deformation of n equals 4. So what do I mean by this? You know that in n equals 4, there are 6 scalar fields. So from the perspective of n equals 1, one can view them as 3 different chiral superfields. And so one gives different masses to those, and then one can see that the theory flows from n equals 4 in the UV to, in the infrared, some n equals 1 Young-Mills theory. So, and this theory can be useful for studying various things. Although in my set of examples, it's probably the most boring. But anyhow, this is one huge area of studying the main moles in supergravity, which give you flows from n equals 4 with various deformations to in low energies to theories with n equals 1. Now, a more interesting case is obtained by deforming, well, brains on conifold singularities. Actually, somebody here already gave some example. I think it was Anton, maybe. So this will sound a bit familiar when he talked about T11, brains on conical singularities. And again, there are a lot of works on that, but the prime example is so-called Klebanov-Strassler background. The Italian paper has many more authors, that's why I don't remember them. Just saying that I'm not dismissing them by not citing them by name. This is in the paper FTH 307191. And here, the idea is that instead of putting brains in flat space, we put them in some other non-trivial geometry, which is actually the conifold geometry. So place and the three brains on the conifold. Now, what that means, actually, at the tip of the cone, I'll mention now a bit more about what the conifold is. So place the brains at the tip of the cone. So the conifold is the following geometry. It's used a lot in these kinds of constructions. So it's a cone with base the space T11. And T11 was the space that can be obtained by, it's a group space SU2 times SU2, modded out in a certain way by some U1. So what does this mean? That it's a cone. It means that the metric of this six-dimensional space is of the form dr squared, r is some radial variable, plus r squared and the metric on T11. Now, I'm not going to give here details about this metric. You can find it in this paper. But let me just say that this space T11 has the topology. So topologically, it's the following. It's S2 times S3. Actually, it's a bit more involved than that. It's S2 times S2, and there is a S1 vibration over that. But anyhow, topologically, it can be viewed as just a product of two spheres of different dimensions. So that's a five-dimensional manifold. And one can use it as a base of a cone. And then putting D3 brains in four flat dimensions plus six dimensions with this geometry, one obtains this kind of situation. And the dual field theory then the dual field theory is n equals 1 conformal field theory. So in order to obtain some RG flow, we need to add some deformation. And the deformation that Klebanov and Strassler thought about is the following. Add some number m. So yeah, like always, n, the number of D3 brains is large. So add some small number of D5 brains that are wrapped on the S2 in that geometry. And this then results in the fact that the dual theory stops being conformal, and now one obtains RG flow. And actually, the RG flow is logarithmic, meaning that the coupling constant in this theory depends logarithmically on the radial distance. So in this theory, the useful thing is that one can study phenomena like confinement. There is also the notion of Zyberg dualities that appears there. But anyhow, so that's a useful laboratory to study various phenomena of interest for actual gauge theories. Now I'm going to get to the most interesting examples, in my view. And so this other way of obtaining field theories with running couplings is by considering much more general situations of wrapped brains. Any questions? OK. So here, this is especially rich. There are many, many works in this area, but again, the prime example that started maybe kind of this field is the Maldacena-Nunes background. It's the same Maldacena from ADACFT, and it's Carlos-Nunes. And the paper is HEPTH 3080001. And so in this paper, they studied NAD5 brains. Wrapped on some two sphere in some geometry. And here and in all setups like this, when you have some kind of stack of brains that you wrap on some cycle. So first of all, here we need a two sphere so that we end up with a four-dimensional effective theory. So what is typical in all those situations is that at low energy effective action, is four-dimensional. But at high energies, the theory becomes higher dimensional, because at high energies, for a D5 brain, for example, the world volume theory is six-dimensional, you know? So at high energies, you're going to probe the whole thing, so the theory is going to become six-dimensional. So at high energies, field theory becomes six-dimensional. And similarly for all other kinds of brains that you can consider, only the numbers of dimensions are going to change. So the issue here is that these are really duals. So the dual theories here should not be viewed as fundamental. Dual field theories are not fundamental. And in particular, they need some UV completion. So the four-dimensional effective theory that we have is only going to be valid below some low enough energy. Above that, we're going to have some other theory, which we don't want to have. So we only have some low energy effective theory in four dimensions, and we need to UV complete it in a different way. So these are not fundamental theories, which is also the case for any non-renormalizable theory, say, in regular quantum field theory. So that's not a great problem. It's just something that one should be aware of. So they're not fundamental and need UV completion. And also in such setups, by choosing what to compactify on, what to wrap on, one can choose, and also certain bounding conditions, one can choose to actually break amounts of supersymmetry, even break all supersymmetry, and get interesting four-dimensional effective theories. Although, again, they would not be fundamental. So now, these were basic ways of obtaining field theories with running couplings. Now let me turn to the issue of renormalization that occurs in general, even in field theories that are not fundamental, that are non-renormalizable. But also we saw in ADS-CFT, too, there were some divergences that were occurring. So the general way to handle such field theories is to try to renormalize them, just like in regular quantum field theory. And in this context, that's called holographic renormalization. And conceptually, we'll see now the steps are really very similar to regular field theory, just that in the gravity side, they really look like regulating infrared divergences. So I'm starting the second point in the plan. Holographic renormalization. So yeah, like I was saying, you can think of those theories like you think about non-renormalizable field theories. So if the theory is finite, that means that you can take it to any arbitrary energy. Like for example, when you compute the integrals in quantum field theory, computing various corrections, then the integrals go to infinity and you get finite answers. If the theory is not renormalizable, we have to introduce some cutoff in order to regulate things. And then you should somehow find a way to introduce counter terms to cancel the divergences, and only then you can take the limit of going to infinity. So the point here also would be that those effective field theories in four dimensions are only going to be varied up to some finite radial distance. You cannot take them to arbitrary distance, because then at arbitrary large radius, they're actually going to be six-dimensional, not the theory that you want to study. So you have to cut off at some distance and add some counter terms, and only then have some effective action that may be viewed as finite. So now in this point, I'm going to make this a bit more concrete. Hopefully it will make more sense. So again, let me write down the basic point that the UV divergences in field theory here are infrared divergences. And the typical reason why this happens is that there are various fields that have non-trivial asymptotics. So to be a bit more concrete, let's take some example. Let's consider some typical set of fields that you have when you have some set of brains that create some background. So typical set of supergravity fields. So you're going to have, of course, some metric. And dualton. And some Ramon-Ramon field, so say some Ramon-Ramon P form. So you know by now, D brains have Ramon-Ramon charges, so they always source some kind of Ramon-Ramon flux. So this will be, say, the minimal set of fields. In various configurations, you may have more than one Ramon-Ramon form, but let's, for now, just consider one. So this is like the minimal set of fields that you're going to have in some gravity background sourced by D brains. So divergences typically would arise, and we would need to do holographic renormalization when we have some of those or all of those fields having non-trivial asymptotics. So IR divergences arise when some or all of those fields have non-trivial asymptotics at spatial infinity, meaning large spatial distance from the origin, so large radial distance at spatial infinity. In flat space, there is no issue, because at large spatial infinity, the metric is just flat, and all the fields go to zero. That's like the standard boundary condition for flat space. But in all other cases, even in ADS, we have non-trivial stuff going at infinity, and that's the reason for the divergences. I'll be more precise in a moment how this happens. Let me just say a few general words about how to deal with that, and then I'll write the action for those fields and try to be a bit more precise about renormalizing it. Okay, let's start here. Thank you. So to remove the divergences, we're going to do, we're going to follow the same basic steps that one follows in field theory. Namely, first one regulates the action, then one adds counter terms, and only then one takes the regulator to infinity. And actually, we're going to see that, or at least I'm going to mention, that finding those counter terms is the same as making the variational principle well-defined. So that's a more conceptual way of deriving them. There are a lot of works, mostly by Skenderis and collaborators, that consider, for example, holographic renormalization for ADS or asymptotically ADS, but they work mostly with directly with components of various things and metric components, expansions near infinity, and it's really not very clear conceptually, so I recommend later references, even some papers, say, by Robert Mann, who are considering holographic renormalization in this more conceptual way, where you can see how the counter terms arise by making the variational principle well-defined, which is what I'll show now in a moment. So first, just conceptually, let me mention, to remove the divergences, like I said, one follows the same procedure as in field theory. So first, regulate and that means introduce a cutoff. So I'll denote this as rho lambda. Like in field theory, cutoffs are usually denoted by lambda, and so this is going to be the radial distance that is the cutoff. So that means that all other radii are less than or equal to rho lambda. So in the field theory, this is a UV cutoff. So usual regulator for ultraviolet divergences. Then it the surface that is determined by R equals R lambda, meaning the spatial surface at fixed radial distance, add counter terms. And let me also call this boundary for the moment. Since we cut off here, this is also the boundary of this regulated space. So we add counter terms to cancel the divergences. And these counter terms are also exactly what we need. What is needed to make the variational principle well defined. This I'm going to show now in a moment with the action for those fields. And finally, the last point is then take the cutoff to infinity. Take the limit R lambda going to infinity. And so once we have renormalized the action in this way, then we use this renormalized action to compute correlators. Remember how in the gauge gravity duality we compute correlators by turning on sources and then differentiating the gravity action with respect to those sources. So here we have to differentiate this renormalized action. Otherwise, we're always going to have some infinities. So now let me use the example of those three fields to make this a bit more precise. So by the way, in principle, one also has to always do this in ADS-CFT, although in this course, we've basically just dropped infinities by hand when we encounter them, because we know that, okay, they shouldn't matter. But the precise thing to do is this holographic renormalization, and it was first developed for ADS and asymptotically ADS, and only later it was understood that it actually comes also from the variational principle for generic backgrounds with non-trivial asymptotics for various fields. So to be more concrete, let's consider the example where we have a metric, the dilaton, and some P form. And so then a typical action, or the action, will be, and now we stay in D dimensions. I don't want to specify the dimension because it depends. If you start with some configuration and you want to dimensionally reduce or whatever, that could be anything between 10 and 4, hopefully. Hopefully we don't want to reduce less than 4. So let's just keep any dimension because this is true for anything. So the action is going to be d plus 1 x. This is the determinant of the metric. Or okay, let me be a bit more precise. And then the Einstein term plus the term for the scalar field for the dilaton. And I hope I didn't take wrong prefactors here, but this should be for a P form, probably this. Although maybe keep in mind that this may not be exactly the right prefactor. And so we have some manifold space-time that is d-dimensional. So that's a typical action for this system of fields that arises in any kind of supergravity background that we have in string theory. And by the way, the Gibbons-Hawking term that I'll mention in a moment also arises actually as a counter term. So although it was obtained decades ago by Gibbons and Hawking, it's like an early example of exactly the kind of term that we're going to derive now for this general situation. So now when well, okay, I don't want to be that precise. You can imagine here. So when one varies the action, schematically, what one obtains is some expressions. So this is generic. It could be, it doesn't have to be related to Minkowski space. Some generic expression that multiplies the variation of the metric. And if there is a cosmological constant, that will be included too, plus some other expression that multiplies the variation of the dilaton, and some other expression. This is actually p minus 1, because this is the variation of the potential. So the p form has potential a here. And so in a moment, I'll add something more. But now let me just say this, that for any manifold, these are the regular equations of motion. So putting the coefficients in front of the variations gives you the standard equations of motion. So if you have just the gravity action, this is going to be the Einstein tensor. And all those coefficients, that's how one derives the equations of motion, right? You vary with respect to some field, and the coefficient in front of it is some expression, and the vanishing of that gives you the standard equation of motion. So these are the standard in field theory, equations of motion for metric, scalar field, and a gauge potential. However, in general, we obtain some additional terms that are boundary terms on the boundary of this manifold M. So this is the boundary of M, right? This is a standard notation. Here, let me denote the coefficient with pi. In a moment, we'll be more clear why. Mu nu, pi phi, delta. So H is the metric on the boundary. And similarly, this curly phi is the boundary value of the duotone. And this small a is the boundary value of the gauge potential. Yeah. So the boundary is, yeah, in our case, this is exactly the cutoff surface at some fixed radial distance. So these are the variations of the boundary values. And these pi's are the conjugate momenta. And so we can understand now, looking at this general form, and well, and this is also the determinant of the metric on the boundary, clearly. So if we have just flat space and all fields going to zero at infinity, we're not going to get any boundary term. But if we have some non-trivial asymptotics, then we have a boundary term. And so the point is that for the variational principle to be well defined, we have to have that the variation of the action vanishes for all variations of the fields. But if we have some non-trivial asymptotics, then we are left with the boundary term. So the field equations that we wanted to get, that were the standard equations in flat space, are actually not null stationary points of this action. So when there are fields with non-trivial asymptotics, the standard equations of motion are not stationary points of the action. One kind of non-trivial asymptotic is just the non-trivial metric in ADS. Another kind that occurs actually in the Malacena-Nunes background is, for example, a duoton that grows and grows at infinity and diverges. So there are all sorts of things like that that happen in the various backgrounds that arise from brains, and that's why we face these issues. So the standard equations of motion on Earth stationary points, and well, let me make a remark here. To be stationary, for the equations of motion to be stationary points, the variation of the action, delta S, must vanish for all variations, for all variations of those boundary H, phi, and A that preserve the same asymptotics. For example, in some backgrounds, like that brain, D5 brain background from in the Malacena-Nunes case, the duoton, let's see where here this goes, like some power of the radius 2 minus d times some, well, okay, the variation of the duoton, times some variation that is only in the transfer space. So this does not contain R. So what that means that for any variation like that that depends only on X, the duoton still should have this kind of behavior. So the action has to vanish for all those variations that preserve this form, this radial dependence. That means to preserve the asymptotics. So we need this in order to have the standard equations of motion. So we need a way to get rid of the boundary terms there. And that's where the counter terms come. Okay, still have a lot of things to say. So I'm not going to go into details about the boundary terms. Let me just mention, well, as an example, for this setup, how the counter terms look like. They have been derived in a paper by Robert Mann and Bob McNeese, who was actually a postdoc here some years ago. So for this set of fields that I've been considering here, the counter term action is the following. It's, of course, on the boundary, which means, again, at the fixed radial distance. And there are some numerical factors that I don't remember. Or not so important, some constant e to minus pi minus 1 plus c2 e to 2p minus 1 r minus e to the phi f squared. And I should also add, so this is not a result of the recent paper. It's known from the time of Gibbons and Hawking, which was, I don't know, maybe 20 years ago. But I should also add the Gibbons-Hawking term as a boundary term, because it occurs also exactly from this procedure of canceling variations on the boundary, which is also living on the boundary, and this is just the extrinsic curvature. So this is extrinsic curvature of the boundary. Which is given by the following contraction. Where this is a normal vector to the boundary, unit normal. So, and well, this is the Gibbons-Hawking term. That has been known for a long, long time. And at the time, it was not understood in this way precisely. But now we can see that it arises exactly. Actually, at the time, it was understood in the context of making the variational principle just for gravity well defined. But it was not understood in terms of canceling divergences. But now we see it in the same context. So now if we add all those counterterms to that action, then the renormalized action is going to be finite. Well, if all the other fields go to infinity, go to zero at infinity, only the metric is non-trivial, then you need just the Gibbons-Hawking term. If you have some other field that diverges, like say the dilaton in the Malosan-Nunes case, then you need some other additional counter term for those other divergences. There may be some interdependence, but if the metric is the only thing that is non-trivial at infinity, then that's the only case that the Gibbons-Hawking term by itself does the job. In what?
In our homework now, we had a black brain and then there's more counterterms.
Don't you have some other fields that are non-trivial?
No.
So what are you considering? I don't know.
Well, you've got ADS space-time with a black brain. And then you need more counterterms than just the Gibbons one.
But what do you mean with a black brain?
The ADS space-time
is sourced by the black brain, or what? Or you put the brain in the ADS?
The planar black hole in ADS.
Okay.
That space-time.
Well, but the black hole, does it have any kind of charge?
No.
Probably does. That's
yeah, I would think that there will be some Ramonian flux.
No such term.
I don't know what to say. Well, without looking in more detail. I don't know. Well, one guess that I could have, but that's just a guess because I haven't derived in detail the Gibbons-Hawking term. Obviously, it was derived at the time just for maximally symmetric spaces, like Minkowski, ADS, and DS. So it could be that in more curved spaces, you need some other curvature terms. I don't know. But in any case, it's relevant. Only it is relevant when you have only metric that is non-trivial at infinity. It could be that you may need something more in more intertwined geometries, but definitely that's about the geometry. The moment you have some other non-trivial fields, you have to add other things to cancel the divergences that arise from them. But actually, oh no, maybe that's the answer. I still think that this is the most general counter term you need if you have just the Einstein action. Maybe if you have higher derivative action, then you will need some other geometric counter term, in addition to the Gibbons-Hawking. But in some cases, you may have R squared or R to the fourth terms or something.
For the planar black hole in ADS or asymptotic ADS, all you have is R plus cosmological constant in your bulk action. Then you need the Gibbons-Hawking counter term and an additional boundary counter term that's proportional to the
But here the cosmological constant is your phi flat, right?
Yeah, okay, I don't know. Maybe I should have put it explicitly and traced how it works there. I don't know. But it would seem strange to me because this term by itself is not obtained by caring about the value of the cosmological constant, whether it's zero or not zero. It's just a geometric variation that arises when you vary the Einstein action. So just when you vary the term, you get something that is just the regular GR equation of motion. I forgot how it went out. Something like minus some factor g mu, whatever, equals zero. I forgot anyhow, let me not write this so it's not wrong. And then you have, so this is the total thing, and then you have some boundary thing, which is exactly proportional to the extrinsic curvature. This is just a geometric fact for this action. From this variation, you cannot get anything else. This you can find even in the book by Wald, General Relativity. Just look in the appendix. So this is the most general thing you get from this action. Maybe there are some other actions that contain terms like r squared or r to the fourth, and they are not really textbooks. So maybe in those cases, there could be other things. But like I said, this is just a textbook thing. You can find it in the book by Wald that is called General Relativity. In some appendix. And it's the only appendix that is called something like action functional or Lagrangian formulation for general relativity, something like that. The rest of the book doesn't really consider action, but in one appendix there is this variation. So this is completely generic only for that action. So I would guess that you need some other thing in the action in order to need another counter term if you have only metric, non-trivial metric. So anyhow, all those things that I was describing now were just giving some running couplings for gauge theories that contain, say, only color degrees of freedom. So now we want to add flavor degrees or fundamental fermions, chiral fermions. Hopefully I'll have some time to talk about this, not so much. So again, let me put in brackets that these are chiral fermions. Fermions that are in the fundamental representation of the gauge group. So I'm assuming there is no need to say anything more about chiral fermions, but let me know if that's not the case. So in the usual case that we get some gauge theory, we have, say, a brain or a stack of brains. And we have some open strings that have both of their ends on the same stack. And then the spectrum contains some adjoint fermions. Gauge fields and adjoint fermions. So now the question is, how can we add fundamental fermions? And a very natural idea is to consider, well, let me again say that this is some D-brains, stack of D-brains. So a very natural idea is to consider some intersecting brains so that then we would have, well, we have the following situation. Let me just, for simplicity, denote this as one line and the open string going. So instead of a whole plane, this is going to be the D-brain. So now, if we have intersecting brains, say we have here some brains that give the color degrees of freedom, NC, the brains. And then we intersect them with some other flavor degrees. And these may be the same, but maybe different dimensionalities. For example, this could be the 3, this could be the 7, or this could be the 4, the 8, different dimensionalities. They don't have to be the same. Now, strings that go between the brains, if one quantizes those kinds of strings, one finds in the spectrum that the lowest level is actually chiral fermions. So this was first studied in a paper by Douglas Lee and somebody, probably in 97 or something. But anyhow, this is well-established computation that has been done in the literature. So one can find chiral fermions at the intersections of different systems of brains. And in fact, if we have, so in cases in which we want to study, say, chiral symmetry breaking, we don't want just chiral fermions. We want to have both chiralities so we can see how the symmetry is broken. So if we have NF D brains of some kind, 7 or 8 or whatever, and then NF anti-D brains, then here in this spectrum, we are going to have, say, chiral fermions that we can call quarks. Whereas here, between the color brains and the anti-brains, we are going to have anti-chiral that we can call anti-quarks. Yeah. Anti-brains just means opposite Ramon-Ramon charge. For every brain, there is an anti-brain, like for electron and positron and quark and anti-quark. And so in this spectra, we can find both quarks and anti-quarks. For example, in this way, we can build some kind of a model that kind of resembles QCD. Now, if we want to actually be more precise and have a gravity dual, then it's a very difficult question to construct a system like that with a full back-reacted metric. So it's very difficult to, well, construct or to solve the coupled supergravity equations of motion for a system of intersecting brains. So for this technical reason, not for any conceptual reason, for this technical reason, what people do is they take the gravity background sourced by, say, the color brains, and then they consider flavor brains as just probes in that background. So then, instead of solving the full equations of motion, consider the flavor brains as probes. That means that we neglect their back reaction on the geometry, and so we describe them just with the DBI action that was also discussed here in previous lectures. I'll write it again soon. But anyhow, so this means that we describe them just with the DBI action. And we neglect their back reaction on the geometry. So that way, the problem gets simplified. And one can study such a complicated system that has also quarks and anti-quarks. And one can study chiral symmetry breaking in such setups. So I was saying that because it's technically very difficult and pretty much It's been done only in very, very rare cases. Most of the time, it's not known what is the full back-reacted solution for intersecting brains. People just, for technical simplicity, take only the color brains to be back-reacted. So they take the geometry that is sourced by the color brains, and then they put probe brains that are flavor brains that introduce the chiral degrees of freedom. But they study the probe brains just as by studying the DBI action for them. So they neglect the back reaction of the flavor brains. And actually, for that reason, the number of flavor brains also always has to be much smaller than the number of color brains. If the numbers are comparable, the back reaction would not be negligible. So OK, maybe I should mention this here. So if the numbers are comparable, it would not be consistent to neglect the back reaction of the flavor brains. So. So we always need the number of flavors to be much less than the number of colors. Otherwise, cannot neglect the back reaction of the flavor brains. So this is an unfortunate technical requirement that sometimes limits the field theories that we want to study. So we cannot directly immediately have a dual of QCD. But it's not a conceptual thing. It's a technical problem for the moment. And with a setup like that, one can really construct very realistic field theories in which one can study various things like chiral symmetry breaking, for example. So let me mention a little bit about that fastly by going to the next point in the talk, which is the Sakai-Sugimoto model. Again, it's often called holographic QCD. So in order to have a model close to QCD, which is what this model is aiming to do, we need a configuration like that. We need to have some color gauge theory, and we need also to have some chiral fermions, so some flavor degrees of freedom. But in addition to that, we also need to be able to describe chiral symmetry breaking. Now, what's that in the QCD vacuum? In the QCD vacuum, there are non-vanishing condensates for quarks and antiquarks. So non-vanishing, non-zero quark condensates. And those break chiral symmetry because, well, chiral symmetry generally means that one can rotate, say, the left or the right independently of each other by some transformation. But when you have a condensate like that, it's just like when you have a mass term. So this is kind of similar to having a mass term. Because of the presence of this term, left and right get mixed. So this is actually, if you write out the components, it's going to be, the indices might be the other way, I'm not sure, but something like that. So the mass term and the condensate, they have kind of the same role, mixes left and right. So you cannot rotate independently only the left component because then the action is not going to be invariant. That's what means that chiral symmetry is broken. So quark condensates break chiral symmetry. That means that one cannot independently rotate or transform only left left-handed or only right-handed fermions. So we need to be able to describe also this kind of phenomenon. And since this board cannot go up, maybe I'll move to some other place, since you can't see the other side. So the big contribution of Sakai and Sugimoto was to understand how to realize chiral symmetry breaking in a geometric way. Otherwise, they actually used some background that was already studied by Witten, sourced by the four brains. So in that sense, maybe it should have been called Witten model. But since Sakai and Sugimoto realized chiral symmetry breaking with some four brains, it's called Sakai Sugimoto model. So it tells you they did less, but they were luckier. They did the most interesting part. Tells you what you strive, what you should strive for. Try to do something small but very interesting. Well, of course, after that they did a lot in terms of studying the model, so I'm not underappreciating their work. So the main contribution conceptually that they had, actually I don't know whether I wrote the paper, maybe not, let me write it. So it's even two papers where this model was first proposed. 04, 1, 2, 1, 4, 1. And the other one, 05, 07, 07, 3. Am I missing? Oh, no. Actually, the first is already enough, but the second develops some things more in interesting ways. So they realized that if you have a setup like on the other board with intersecting brains, but so you have some background sourced by color brains, and you have flavor and anti-flavor brains, but instead of intersecting, they go only up to some finite distance, say something like that. So this is some stack of NF. And let me even specify the Sakai Sugimoto case was, so these were the four brains sourcing the background, and these were the eight brains introducing the flavor degrees. So, and here we have the eight brains. And so this is the radial distance. And let's call this tentatively zero. And so this is going to be some non-vanishing row zero. So some radial distance away. So then this kind of configuration realizes chiral symmetry breaking. And this distance kind of geometrizes this notion of quark condensates. So this setup gives geometric realization of chiral symmetry breaking. And one can also see geometrically how that happens. So this stack of brains is going to have some flavor group that is SUNF. And let's call this right. And this one is going to have a group that is called SUNF left. So these are global symmetries of rotation of only left-handed or right-handed. Yeah? No, no, it's not the same. The two stacks are merging at some finite distance. So right, the lower stack is 8 bar. Upper stack is 8. And remember that this is not in flat space. So it's not like having parallel brain and anti-brain in flat space, and they just annihilate, and that's the end of the story. This is some non-trivial background. So it's also like if you imagine some electron propagating in some non-trivial electromagnetic fields, it's not going to immediately annihilate with the positron. Depends where they are in those fields and whatnot. So this is a non-trivial background. And for every non-trivial background, one has to compute separately whether the spectra of particles, whether they're tachyons or not, tachyonic modes. So this is some very non-trivial background sourced by the D4 brains. And in that background, Sakai and Sugimoto showed actually that there is a configuration like that that minimizes the DBI action for the D8 brain, configuration in which D8 and D8 bar merge at some finite distance. Well, this should be vertical, right? Well, it's not very vertical. So this, now one can see how, so just like here, there was the gauge group that is SU and C. For the flavor brains, we have groups, but now they're just global rotations of the left-handed or right-handed fermions. And because the brains merge, we see that those groups are now not independent anymore. So we have SU and F left times SU and F right is actually broken to some diagonal subgroup. And that's exactly what happens in QCD. If we have NF equals 3, that will be exactly the situation in QCD. In QCD, we would have some left flavor group and right flavor group that act on left and right quarks. And chiral symmetry breaking, or the presence of quark condensates, means that actually they stop being independent, but instead only a subgroup, diagonal subgroup, is now preserved. Because you have to act both on the left and on the right to preserve the quark condensate to keep that invariant under this action. So this is a generalization of this setup. So again, like I was mentioning before here, the number of flavors has to be much less than the number of colors so that we can use the probe brain approximation for the D8. So this is a technical constraint that is not very desirable, because in QCD, both flavor and color are equally small. So in that sense, it's different. But nevertheless, conceptually, it's very similar. So that's really the best attempt so far to obtain, well, a gauge theory with properties similar to QCD. And how what? No, no, the D4 was, I meant that the color degrees of freedom are due to the D4. So imagine that this is the D4. Of course, that's a bit primitive, because now we don't have just the D4 with strings, but we consider the limit in which we substitute with a gravity background of sources. So, and then that would be the origin of that background. But the source of that background is the D4 brains. So these are the D4, and these are the D8. So remember, these are kind of dual perspectives, right? Either you view things as just having brains and open strings ending on them, or in order to have a gravity dual, you take the limit in which you substitute the brain with a background source with some non-trivial geometry. So in that geometry, you don't have anymore the brain, you just have a geometric background. And that's the background in which we place those probes. But conceptually, this came from before that you can imagine maybe sitting in your opinion. So anyhow, there is this technical reason for things to actually be different, but nevertheless, the physics of this model is very, very close. And I'm almost out of time, but let me just mention, so I don't have time to write the background, but you can see it in those papers. And one characteristic feature here was that the dilaton is actually diverging. It's going like R2. So this is one interesting background in non-trivial dilaton asymptotics. But the more important thing I wanted to mention was, I wanted to give an example of how close it comes to QCD when you compare ratios of, say, some vector and axial vector meson masses. So in this model, you can compute spectra of various things like scalar vector mesons. Let me just take maybe 5 more minutes to tell you a bit about that. So okay, so you can study meson spectra. Remember, mesons are bound states of quarks and antiquarks. And for example, scalar mesons arise from fluctuations of the D8 embedding . I don't have much time, let me not go into more detail into that. But the next more interesting point is vector mesons. So you can compute the spectrum of masses, various couplings. But there is one free parameter that is the reason that one has to compare ratios in this model to ratios in QCT rather than absolute values, because this parameter cannot be fixed in this model. So it's some mass scale that I did not mention because I didn't have time to write the background. Anyhow, so vector mesons, they arise from fluctuations of the D8 world volume field strand . So let me just remind you the DBI action that you've seen in previous lectures. Since this 8 brain, we have 9 world volume directions, and the square root of determinant . This is the induced metric, induced from the background on the world volume, plus there is the world volume field strand. This is the flavor field, that was related to the groups SUNF left and SUNF right. And well, just for a fast comparison with QCD, let me mention that two basic sets of kinds of states in QCD are vector and axial vector mesons, and they differ by their parity. So vector, they're symmetric with respect to parity, axial vector anti-symmetric. So parity in this model actually can be related, well, it's just the interchange of D8 and D8 bar. Because in general, parity means exchanging left and right. And here, the left and the right-handed fermions came from D8 and D8 bar. So, and then one can see that this interchange of D8 and D8 bar can be translated into reflection with respect to the world volume radial coordinate. So if I introduce a world volume, sorry, this may be not so clear, but I don't have much time. So if I introduce some world volume radial coordinate, that would mean that, say, I had this shape for D8 and D8 bar. So then the variable z is going to have, say, 0 here, and go, let's say, here to minus infinity and here to plus infinity. So we have to do a change a variable from R to Z that can be done. So then, in terms of such a world volume coordinate, parity is just going to be a reflection, Z going to minus Z. So then, parity. And so then one can study the various states in decomposing this field. One can study the various states that are symmetric or anti-symmetric with respect to this. And one can find spectra for axial and vector, for vector and for axial vector mesons. And since I'm out of time, let me just mention that one kind of result is for the mass squared. Like I said, one can compute masses and couplings of various fields. So in the ratio of the mass squared of the first axial vector meson to the first vector meson is, so in this, in Sakai Sugimoto model, it's roughly 2.4 in Sakai Sugimoto, whereas in QCD, it turns out to be 2.5. So you can see that things are very similar. And so the rho meson is the first vector meson state. By first, I mean there's the whole tower of infinitely many in principle. And A1 is the first axial. So the point of this comparison is that things really come close. And well, one can compare also for higher states, things are similar. Well, above some certain level, things start becoming different. So this model is similar, but not exactly the same. But it's very useful in order to study various things that really happen in QCD. And again, I was saying one should compare only ratios of quantities computed in this model to ratios computed to ratios measured experimentally, because there is a mass scale that comes, something I did not say here because I didn't have time to go in detail about the background, but the D4 brains are actually compactified on a circle. And there is a mass scale that comes from the circle, which cannot be fixed in any conceptual way. So all of those masses are proportional to that mass scale. So we have to take ratios to get rid of that, and only then we can compare to measure things. Otherwise, that scale is just some free parameter. So the D4 brains that source the background are actually compactified on a circle. So that then we would have some four-dimensional effective theory, right? If we didn't compactify, it would be five-dimensional. And so the kind of the radius of that circle shows up as some mass scale in every answer here. So we can only compare ratios. Anyhow, the point is that this model is quite good approximation for QCD, although, of course, one would want to obtain even better things. But as long as we cannot backreact the flavor brains, that's the best we can get for now. But this kind of ideas also is useful to study models of dynamical electric symmetry breaking. And I'm out of time. Let me just say that in those cases, so this is an alternative to the Higgs. So instead of having a Higgs coupled to the standard model fields, one has some other gauge theory, some new additional gauge sector that also has some new fermions. And similarly to the color gauge theory in QCD, it's called Technicolor. And the new fermions are called technifermions. And they also can have technifermion condensates like the condensates in QCD. And the formation of those condensates actually induces the breaking of electric symmetry. So one can construct models of this kind of dynamical electric symmetry breaking with the same kind of construction like in the Sakai Sugimoto model, but having different kinds of brains with the same kind of embedding for flavor and anti-flavor brains merging at some finite distance. So anyhow, this is kind of a fruitful area nowadays to study. Yeah? Oh, IND, meaning induced. Oh. The metric that is induced from the background on the world volume.
I'm guessing the B field is trivial in that way.
Yeah, the internal B field. Say much about the background, but there is also, of course, a non-trivial Ramonov flux. It's a four-form. So, well, if there are any questions, that's it.